Welcome to the changing of the guard. Ask me anything with Veronica Quarterly Publishing. And we're honored to have here with us the brain trust of Veronica Quarterly. We have Tom Devlin here, now executive editor, as Peggy Burns, now the publisher, and publisher soon to be emeritus, Chris Oliveros. And, you know, we had a, there was a, they threw a very lovely reception last night where we kind of faded Chris, and one of the attendees there pointed out that, you know, he was handling the changeover in the company with the same integrity and intelligence with which he had run the company. And I think that's a very good way to look at it. And I mean, I'm sure if you're here in the audience, you don't need me to tell you how amazing the history of Veronica Quarterly has been for 25 years, and the level of artistry, the number of cartoonists, I mean, the list goes on and on, of how many great comics they published. So with great appreciation, I present to you Veronica Quarterly. Now, but in case you have missed the news, let me just you know, lay it out there. So, Chris, you founded the company 25 years ago as a nipper of 23, and you have decided to return to your cartooning roots, correct? To draw comics now?
Well, more or less. I'm not in coming out the door. I'm still associated with the company. And I think what it comes down to is that a lot of the general tasks that I've been doing didn't really require me to be doing them, like whether it's, you know, shipping lists or diamond solicitations or whatever. So essentially, like, a lot of my general tasks are going to be handed over, and I'll probably still be working on some level editorial with Tom Peggy. So, you know, it'll be definitely scaled back, and I'll have more time to do my own work as well.
Well, we'll quiz you about your comics in a few moments here. But for Peggy and Tom, you know, what how does this change what you've been doing and what you will be doing? What is the transition for you?
You know, I mean, it kind of feels like a big change. I was thinking when it was Friday when the article came out, and then I was like, oh, it's out there, everybody knows about it. And I got a little panicked, and I actually kind of thought, like, I'm going to walk down the street from the hotel to the library here to set up the Friday night event, and people are going to boo me, because I'm not Chris Oliveros. It's like, you ruined it! You drove him out! But, I mean, I don't think it's going to really change that much, because, like Chris said, he'll still be kind of, like, editorially saying, you know, like, this is a good book, or, you know, like, I do like this book, or I don't like this book, you know, it's not something we should do. He just won't be, you know, sitting 5 feet from me constantly.
So he can move around, he can move about more, basically. And Peggy, for you?
It will change for me because I will actually be doing less publicity. I will only be, like, planning the publicity. Julia Paul Miranda, who you guys all know from doing the shows here, will be doing most of the publicity. And I'll be taking over most of the business work that Chris does. So that will become my domain. And then for all of Chris's production duties that he does, we're hiring someone new to come in and handle that. So
an orderly transition. Well, let's take it back. I mean, we are here to celebrate the 25th anniversary, and, you know, the show kicked off with an amazing lineup of some of the cartoonists you published, you know, talking about their work. And but Chris, let's walk back down memory lane to 25 years ago. And what made you think that this was something you wanted to do? What made you want to publish comics?
I was always interested in comics. I grew up reading comics. I almost certainly would not have ever decided to start my own publishing company because I didn't have any experience, you know, running a magazine or publishing house for that matter. It was just it was almost a coincidence that one particular summer when I was 21 or 22, a group of people got a grant from the Quebec government for just that summer to work on a comics magazine. I somehow got hooked up with them and we put out this magazine. It wasn't a very good magazine, but it gave me the experience, and I thought, well, maybe I can do a better job myself. And then, you know, the following year, that's when I sort of just worked towards that.
Now, was your background at that time in production or editing or art or
No production, no editing, nothing at all. I was, my only qualification was that I was, you know, interested in comics. I drew comics as well. And went to art school in New York, but I had no other experience in publishing at all.
Were there artists at that time, as you were putting together the magazine, that really inspired you or really fired you up about publishing them? Or
yeah, I mean, I guess I came of age in the 1980s when what was then called alternative comics was just really getting off the ground. So I mean, the, you know, Raw magazine was a very big deal, and of course, you know, Miles, because originally serialized in Raw. And then, you know, Gary Groth, Kim Thompson did Fantagraphics. That was very influential. Chester Brown starting Yummy for the late 80s. So yeah, I mean, all that was very important.
So, and the first, like you did start out with an anthology magazine. It's called Drawn Quarterly Anthology. And so you got to know, I'm assuming, so, I mean, there was that little cartooning crowd here, Seth and, you know, Chester Brown and, you know, Julie Doucet came aboard. So it was kind of looking around. I mean, did you know these people from around? Did they approach you?
I think it was a question of being in the right place at the right time. Because it was just like that particular moment I started out. And many of these cartoonists were starting out already. So I started seeking out work for the anthology. So many of these cartoonists were, you know, just starting their careers, just starting to do short stories for the anthology. But as I corresponded with these people, it turned out that many of them were doing longer works as well. And just that moment. So Julie Doucet was, at that moment, looking, she wanted to publish comic book series. Seth, you know, just at that moment, coincidentally, was just about to complete his first issue of Galuptico. You know, so it was a question of one thing leading to another. You know, first of all, there was Julie, then there was Seth, and then there was, you know, Joe Matt, who at the time was living in Montreal. And they were all friends, and they were friends with Chester Brown. And even though Chester Brown had already started publishing comics about 4 or 5 years before then, I was pestering him for a good, you know, 12 months or so to come over to Drawn Quarterly. And he said no a few times until finally he agreed.
Well, he had, I think he and Seth had both started at a previous Canadian comics publisher called Vortex.
Right.
The aptly named Vortex for those who remember. So, so you were luckily there.
There weren't many books left at Vortex, really, like at that time. Chris has said this before, is that they had started publishing like NASCAR comics.
Yeah.
And there was something else that seemed very odd. It was like a Major League Baseball comic or something. Like, they were just been licensing stuff and Yummy Fur. So the timing was good because Chester was like, what am I doing here?
No, just
didn't hear.
I mean, that was my argument to Chester. I would say to Chester, like, why are you in this company with like publishing NASCAR comics? There's nothing to do with what you're doing. And he said, I'm fine. And you know, and then, but I did offer more money, and it was the money that swayed him.
Yeah, it was the coffers. He opened the coffers after on a quarterly. So. We'll jump forward a little bit. Even though Tom and Peggy came as a package deal, but unknown at the time, as she said, you were telling me the other night. So Peggy, I know history. Peggy and I, you worked together. We were office mates at DC Comics, very unlikely. And Peggy controlled the thermometer in my office, so I would often go into her office to cool things down or heat them up or whatever. And of course, we struck up a friendship. And at a very unusual company.
Yep, but that's no longer
just memories of all the Hall of the Failed Imprints. Remember the, as I called it. Anyway, I wasn't really aware that you harbored this desire to jump from, you know, Vertigo Comics and Preacher and Neil Gaiman and all that to something a lot more literary, I suppose. So what was going on in your mind at the time?
I was a very casual reader of comics before I got to DC Comics. I read the Twisted Sister compilation, I read issues of 8-Ball, and I read, like, you know, boyfriend comics like Usagi Yojimbo, you know. And, you know, I always liked the comics. I didn't seek them out, though. And then this was back in the internet bubble, and everyone wanted a job, an e-job, you know, no description.
And can I mention, please? There is a counterpart in our loading dock that needs to be moved so that we can get delivery in there. There's a car in the loading dock at the back of the library that needs to be moved. It's a Nissan Armada. It's black. The license plate number is BWZC776.
Okay.
I better go then. Right.
So, I was at a PR firm and I was looking for a job on monster.com, because that's what you did. And there's a position open for like 2 or 3 weeks for publicity manager at DC Comics, Warner Brothers. And I went in for the interview and they were like, just want to make sure you know, you will never be able to transfer it to Warner Brothers Films or TV. This is just for the comic books. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. That's totally fine with me. It was also Mad Magazine. So when I got there, you know, and we'd go to Hanley's every Wednesday night. I mean, the superhero stuff did not speak to me. I appreciated the tradition, and the stunts were always amusing. Like when the DCU would call me down to the sixth floor, they'd be like, "We got this crazy idea. Stan Lee's going to recreate the DC universe." And I was like, I don't know much about superhero comics, but that's all really lame. And so I was always drawn to the Vertigo stuff. Like just being able as a publicist to like just have one author and build a publicity campaign around one author, to me was always much more natural. And then when we started going to Hanley's, I just devoured all the comics in the alternative section. And of course when you do that, you go by publisher. There are only two publishers where you enjoy every single book they've ever done, which is, sorry about that, Highwater and Charm Quarterly. So, you know, I married one and worked for the other.
she was drawn in. Well, Tom, you were having a parallel development at this time with your own historic Highwater Press. And so, what drew you to comics?
You know, I was always interested in comics, and I edited some comics a little bit, but I wasn't, I guess, disciplined enough to ever get particularly good at it. But I had a number of jobs, like, through my 20s, and it was always that kind of, it was always slacker jobs, like record stores and things like that. And I got bored with most of the jobs pretty quickly. I'd work pretty hard and then I'd just get bored and not be a very good employee. But whenever it was a comics thing, I stayed kind of interested. And I think part of that is that new comics would always be coming in, so I'd get kind of, you know, freshly excited. And it was a pretty exciting time too for, you know, like it was the second generation underground build, the alternative comics people were, you know, that was kind of booming, I guess. So there was a lot of stuff I was interested in reading. So I was working at a comic shop, and I was in charge of the alternative comic section and the mini comics, and I started meeting all these mini comics people, and I really liked their work, and I remember very specifically saying that Fantagraphics or Drawn Poorly will not publish this stuff. Like, this doesn't fit with either one of them, so I should just become a publisher. So I started publishing stuff. And I got very lucky in that, the second book I created, the first book I created was a comic scene, and I translated it in French. I had a friend translate it into French. She knew something like seven languages, so I thought, well, this is perfect. I'll just have my roommate's girlfriend translate, these comics into French. She didn't know French. I found out later, so it's really a hack job. And I took it to Angoulême, the big French comics festival, because I'd heard that it was this promised land of comics opportunity. So I was like, I'm going to take my friends to France. The French are going to love them, and everybody's going to be swimming in money. And I walked around handing out this mini comic anthology, and people did not know what to make of it. It was like, I don't know if it was like, it just wasn't a thing. You don't do that. You do it here in the States. Like, people hand zines to each other all the time, but they were like, "What? Why are you giving this to me?" And it was pretty, rough in some ways, of course. But I really kind of loved making that, even if the response was a little lukewarm. So I came up with another idea, and that's when I did the Marvel Benefit book.
Cooper Steeper.
Yeah. And the Marvel Benefit book, people went crazy for. I had alternate cartoonists draw Marvel characters. Marvel had declared bankruptcy recently, so I was going to raise money for them to help them out by giving away a free comic. So I got all these alternative cartoonists to draw their favorite superheroes, and they were supposed to do it straight, but even the one I did was kind of not straight. You kind of couldn't help but do a little parody. And I gave the copyrights for all the characters to the individual people who drew the comic stories, which, of course, you can't. But so I said, Hulk is copyright James Kachalka, with the explicit intention that I want to get sued by Marvel for publicity. And that didn't happen. They didn't care.
You have no money to sue you.
I gave it to a Marvel representative at Comic-Con, and he made a joke that, I'd be hearing from their lawyers, but there was no reason.
Your hopes were dashed?
There was no reason for them to pursue.
You gave it to a DC Comics anthology, and then you were
fascinated. I know. That's, I got that totally wrong. I actually had a friend turn into Jimmy Olsen's story. He didn't know the difference. And I had to reject it. And I was like, you can't be it. You're spoiling the theme.
I think, High Order Press put out some amazing books, and then it went out of business.
Was working for Drawn Poorly then.
Right. Okay. So you, I want to get into that middle period. Peggy, you moved to Drawn Poorly in 2003. And Tom, when did you start working for Drawn Poorly?
Well, Marina, Chris's partner, who's right there, she had Charles, who's not here, but she had Charles. I started in October 2003. She had Charles in April of 2004. And so Chris was gone. He had three kids at home. And so there were just little things I needed production-wise, just like ads and, little things that I wasn't going to call him in to do. So I would just have Tom do them. And Tom was in the apartment back in Montreal, so then he was like, sure, I'll do this. And then I think...
I didn't have a job.
He didn't have a job, yeah. Or high water was his job. And so then his first project, I think, that he did was Band of Beans and Black Tea, right?
Yeah.
And that's the Seth's memoir from his dad. And so Tom made the Seth font for the book, right?
We might have had somebody make it. Yeah. I think we might have sent it out. But I would just come in to the office and help out because I was kind of bored at home. Okay, I did some freelance stuff, but I didn't have a
lot of work. So I was just like, well, if I go in and pack these boxes or whatever, then Peggy can come home and we can have dinner together. So I might as well just go help. So I did that for a while.
Now, did you, at this time, this is an interesting period in comics because, you know, the 90s were a bleak time for comics, and you had come through them, you know, publishing periodicals. And I think by this time, like in the early 2000s, the graphic novel had really become much more what a lot of people were looking at, you know, as a form that was viable, and also for a really great storytelling form, you know. And I mean, was it around this time that you feel that format became more viable, and you know that you moved away from periodicals, or you know, how did that transition take place?
Well, as you noted, when Drawn and Quarterly started in that first decade, almost all comics were being published as periodicals, and which meant that they were mostly 24-page comic books. So if a cartoonist had a longer story, let's say you had a 200-page story, you would actually publish it into several comic books, you know, could be 8 comic books, and it would later be collected into what's now called a graphic novel. But in those first 10 years, there was a very small market for graphic novels. Bookstores didn't carry it at all. Comic stores were kind of carrying it. So if you were a publisher, that was your only option. You had to publish pamphlets. The other thing is the pamphlets were sold for $2 or $3. So that even though sales were actually usually pretty good, you know, you're not going to be making a lot of money on that. So it was also very important to have a company like this could not have an office with employees and payroll. They just would, you know, if you do the math, you could have, let's say, if you had 6 successful titles and each one made a profit of, I don't know, $3,000 per year. There's no money to pay for, you know, payroll and rent and everything. So the first half of the 90s was, for D&Q, was quite successful. And I mean, it continued to be successful in the latter half of the 90s, but the latter half was sort of more of a holding pattern where a lot of things were, it was very shaky. Some of the major comic book distributors went bankrupt. I think we started off in the beginning of the decade with about 10 distributors, and then by the end of the decade, there was one distributor. It was the monopoly. So it looked really, really shaky. And I would say the turning point came in 2000 with a book, with Chris Ware's book, Jimmy Corrigan, because while publishers like Drawn and Quarterly and Fandor Graphics were slowly paving the way for the acceptance of graphic novels, you know, both in terms of the content and the format. It really wasn't until the book Jimmy Corrigan came out that something really changed, and I think you were able to sense it then. All of a sudden, the media was really talking about it. There were news stories, articles being written about this. And then bookstores were just starting to take notice again. So that by 2001, 2002, there was really the very beginnings of a sea change, where the pamphlet format that was, you know, ruled in the 90s, that was going down, and then the graphic novel format was just starting to take off. The only problem is that things, you can't just transition like in, you know, overnight or even in 1 year. I mean, just there's all sorts of factors. I mean, so with Drawn and Quarterly, went from being a small company with very little overhead to you know, quite a bit of a larger company. But the larger company sort of happened before the larger sales happened. So it was a rough transition for quite a while.
But you had a very good publicist to help you.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Now, obviously, yeah. I mean, that was really important, having the really good team in place. I mean,
I think the comic book market, when you just do pamphlets, it's not just that the pamphlets are cheap. Everything's cheap. You go to the Comic Con, You know, the books weren't that expensive. You sold a lot. Everything was cheap. But in the book market, it's expensive to get the attention of the book market. You have to send your author on tour. Tours are expensive. You have to, you know, do press meetings and get pressed in order to support your books in the book market. So it wasn't even just getting the distributor, but it's getting the capital to print the book. And if it does well, having money to be able to reprint the book. If you're not able to do the production, you have to hire somebody else to do the production and the publicity. So there's all these expenses that just came on in 2003 to 2007 that, you know, really kind of buried us, but we just kept plugging along. The three of us just knew. We were just like, we just, you know, got to do it. We can do this.
But that was also something, I think, like, you know, Tom, and the work that you had been doing, the publishing you were doing, I think you, you know, always had your eye on a prize that was, you know, storytelling that was more complete in one story, or, you know, developing a story as a longer narrative.
Oh, yeah, very specifically, I by that point, I had worked at Diamond Comic Distributors for a number of years, and I had worked in, at Millionaire Picnic in a comic shop, and at that point, I kind of hated comic books, comic pamphlets, and I was like, graphic novels, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a graphic novel publisher. And I was convinced that it might take two or three or four books, but I was going to have like a successful book. And then that was just going to launch the whole lineup, because, you know, I could see graphic novels were where it's at, and a lot, and nobody knew this yet, and, you know, and I was going to catch it. And Drummond Quarterly was publishing graphic novels by this time. I was totally deluded, once again, like I just had it all wrong, but I was kind of working in the right direction.
What was your best-selling book?
I think it was Haven, yeah. It was like 5,000.
Well, the book is out, the 25th anniversary book is out, which, I don't know if it's still available. Is it available here? Or mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so sure. You should, yeah. And it has, you know, a lot more of the history, in-depth details. Such an amazing book, great comments, great stories. I, you know, I don't want to go through too much of that, but, because you can read it in the book. But I think one of the big successes that you had was Chester Brown with Louis Riel, right?
Yes.
And that was, like what was the...
season that I came to Drummond Quarterly came in September 2003, and I had to promote Joe Sacco's The Fixer and Chester Brown's Louis Riel.
Yeah, tough.
Yeah. So, and Chester's book really took off in Canada. Like, it really just... And Chris explained to me, because like maybe the first week we were talking about Manic Beans and Black Tea, it was crazy. He's like, well, Seth Stan wrote a book and we're publishing it. And I was like, what? It's not even comics. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And he was like, no, Canadians really like books about Canada. You'll see. You'll see. And he was very true. It was very, and so, and Louis Riel, I mean, it's an amazing book. And it still does a fantastic, even, you know, 10 years later.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still, you know, I mean, I think this is like a dream. I mean, I know, you know, discussing it over the years with you, but all three of you just, you know, having this hope that comics would come out in this format and it would still be sold 10 years later, you know, and people would still be reading it, discovering it, and you know. Of course, you couldn't do that without the incredible cartoonists that you've published over the years. And I wonder how you see, I'll throw this open to the panel, I mean, how do you see, like, the change in developing cartoonists now? You know, from discovering them or, you know, developing them, signing them up. I mean, how, you know, it's a huge change, but I mean, is there, you know, any observations you have on it? Like, how the job has changed in that way?
I would say one of the big changes is that years ago, I found it was very difficult to find talent. There were amazing talents they developed years ago. You know, many people who mentioned, but it was still very, very. There weren't many cartoonists. Many of the cartoons coming out. Sometimes you go through a 5-year period, it would be like, you know, a handful of incredible talents coming out. I think what's changed is that I think because of the fact that over these, you know, these decades, there's been so much good work and sort of this is accumulating good work. And now, you know, the younger generations, I guess, have been influenced by that and also the changing market. There's so much more good work being produced now. I mean, it's just, I think we're sort of in the best possible time we could be in, because you've got a lot of that older generation who are still around and in many cases doing the best work of their careers. I mean, that's incredible. They're still working and so good. But then you have so many other cartoonists. I mean, just even like the last 5 years alone, there's been like, you know, maybe like 20 good cartoons I can think of that are like incredible. And it's actually hard to keep up now. It's really, really hard to keep up with all of the material that's coming out. And that's a big difference.
Business-wise, I think a lot, business has been on how popular graphic novels are. You know, when I sit there and I do like a Spiegelman or a Barry signing here at TCAF, every single person comes up and says, I read your book in my class. Now, you know, I graduated in the 90s. I didn't read one comic book in university. And I was, you know, women's studies and media and took a lot of English classes and never once. And now you just read graphic novels the whole time. So I think for people to come across it, it's not because your boyfriend reads Yusaki Ojimbo or things like that, or your bookstore has it. It's just there's everywhere now, or the library has a store.
I don't know. I mean, I guess that this is probably going to be a long digression, but I think what I was thinking about is that if you were you're into comics and you went to the same place, same couple of places, you went to the comic shop in the city, if you lived in the suburbs like I did, you do that every couple of months or something, and maybe buy your regular comics at like corner store, the Cumberland Farms, in Westwood Center, like I did. And of course, that did not have much selection. I remember one time, like they had heavy metal on the rack, and I was like, "Oh, I know this is the different stuff." And I tried to buy it, and the guy wouldn't sell it. So I was like, "That's that."
Yeah, you were too young to buy it.
Yep. So I didn't go anywhere with that for a couple of years. But you kind of had to hunt a bit to just even find, like, it's kind of like you just kept reading stuff, waiting for the thing, you know, and then finally, like, there started to be an accumulation, like, kind of the second generation of underground cartoonists, alternative comics, like Finding Love and Rockets, and then, you know, 8-Ball, and Hate, and Yummy Fur, and then that just kind of exploded, Blue Cavill and Dirty Plot. And so now I think it's kind of like it isn't. I mean, I'm imagining it's not so hard now. Like you're just like, I'm into those. Michael Ford was talking about the first alternative comic he got, or the first Chess Round comic he got was Louis Real 3 or something. And so, you know, I mean, that seems crazy. Like a high school kid or, you know, junior high kid would go pick up comics and learn it that way. So there's so many more people, you know, making them. It's almost like you don't have to hunt for it.
Right.
Things that where so many submissions come through the door every day, and it used to be the case that there were almost never ever a good submission.
Who was your last one? Keith Jones.
Brett Evans was a blind submission a few years ago, and Keith Jones was. But it happens more often where we actually see, like, you know, this happening. And I just walked through the Wowie Zonk room, and I thought, like, well, I know what's going on here. You know, and I found a handful of things that I was like, I've never heard of this person, and this is amazing.
It's daunting. It's expensive and daunting. I don't think I'm overstating to say that it's the work that you've done that have really created and helped create the environment where this is possible and, you know, can inspire so many. So looking ahead, I think probably, Chris, we have to put you on the spot. So you are returning to, you want to concentrate on your own work. So, I mean, what is your own work? What are you looking forward to doing?
Years ago, I actually did start working on a book, and it was so long ago that it was during the era of when books would be serialized. So I did actually put out the first two chapters of a three-part book. The only problem is every time when each of the chapters were published, I actually really hated it after they came out. I sort of wanted to disown the work.
Classic cartoonist.
And then I actually kind of abandoned it after the second one was done, never finishing the third one. And I just thought, okay, that's it. That's, you know, I wasn't happy the way it turned out. But I never. There's something always brought me back to it. You know, it's this illogical instinct to actually just to do this. So something brought me back, and I developed a schedule a few years ago where I would wake up early in the morning, like around 5:30, and work in the first 90 minutes of the day before my kids would wake up and we'd have breakfast and so on. And finally, now I'm at the point where I'm almost finished this book. It also took me a long time because I started from scratch. So I disliked the first two chapters so much that everything was chucked out. And I started from scratch, so now the book is almost done. It's 100 pages. So I redid the first two chapters and then also completed the third one. So now I'm about to finish it next month. It's going to be out in January. And while I was doing this, I realized that actually I like doing this. And then I had other ideas to do other books as well, and I wanted to start a second one probably in July this year. But I realized that I'll never finish a second one because it's really difficult to have this like short schedule in the morning. And I'm not getting any younger, so I figured, well, you know, I probably should try to at least scale back what I'm doing for the rest of the day, just in order like, to try to get some of this done.
Now, so we don't have to wait too long, only a few months. Now, what is the name of your book?
It's called The Envelope Manufacturer.
Right, and what is it about?
It's a book about an envelope manufacturer.
Truth in advertising.
It's a manufacturer of envelopes. I'll let you guys.
It's not a small businessman. He runs a small company.
Yes.
They own the paper.
Yes.
It sounds like a journey of discovery. And you'll laugh and you'll cry. So you're not going to do autobiographical copies. You're not going to do...
No.
Okay. That is a Donna Farley vision. But are you, you know, I mean, you feel, I mean, you haven't set the timetable for the transition at this point, right?
It's probably going to be soon, probably in late June or July.
Nervous that Chris is so sweet, so nice, he'd be there forever. You know, just like, you know, not wanting to cause any trouble. And so I told Tracy to, like, get in there, get some work from Chris, and I've been trying to get more things from him. And he's doing it. He's delegating with a smile. He's excited. He's like, yeah, you can do that.
Sure.
Wow. And so now we're kind of like, oh, wait, he's serious. He really does want to leave. He wants to get out of here. So.
Well, that's wonderful. So Tom and Peggy, you know, as you've been joking all weekend, the American era begins. But, I mean, you have a very successful formula, and you have been, both of you have been so integral in running the company. So it's not like we're going to have a shocking changeover here. Or is there?
No.
Secret shock.
And Chris is still, the way Chris is still going to be involved is in editorially. I mean, so if there's, I mean, basically, I think we'll still meet like once a month or whenever we need to talk about the list. And the three of us, I said, we're not a very nice threesome because we're always changing sides. There's no loyalties. Like, you know, Chris and I will go yell at Tom about a book, or Tom and Chris will approach me about, I did cartoonist they want to publish. And I'm like, no. Tom and I will go to Chris. So, but I mean, I did say to Chris, I was like, you know, I have to say, when he told me, I was like, I don't want to be debating, like, my husband about what books to publish. Like, I need your help there. I can't do that on my own. And he said, well, that's the only thing you need, and I'd be happy to do that. So.
Oh, I see secret alliances are already beginning.
Yeah, because she was afraid of too many long books, as she called them. Yeah.
It's true.
Well, Tom, you do have, I'll throw you a bone here, Tom. Like, I mean, you do have an amazing knowledge of comics of the past, and, you know, you did some books that I really love, the John Stanley books, and, you know, that probably, you know, the series didn't go as long as we would have wished. And, but who are some...
Tom's books tend to sell extremely, extremely well, and then on the other end of things.
Do you have a cartoon?
Sometimes the public isn't ready.
Okay.
From last year was Beautiful Darkness.
Oh, right.
And that was a book where they showed it to me, and the French cover was so ugly. Like, I looked at that cover, and I don't read French.
It's like a deep blue, and
it looked like
not getting reading.
I said that looks like erotic porn fairy.
Yeah, you called it the sexy fairy book.
And I was like, I don't like it. No. And then they came together, and Chris was like, no, we like this book. And then of course you just say yes.
That book was like, wow. I mean, people went berserk for that book. Yeah. Got BuzzFeed and just went wild. Is there anything publicly that you can reveal about upcoming Drone Quarterly? Anything that we should look forward to? Or, you know, I mean, we have a lot of, you know, our new book bill is out, and some really good stuff. But anything else that we should look forward to coming out this year?
We have Adrian's book this fall, Killing and Dying, which will collect the last 3 albums of Murders. New Kate Eaton collection. I mean, this is sort of stuff that's been announced, right?
Yeah.
I don't recall.
You know, I did have. This was called AMA, so I did ask for some internet questions, and there was a question.
No.
Yes, no. I know we have to do truth and advertising here. So one question for the fan: are we doing? When will there be a new issue of Berlin?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah, all right. Well, there we go. The answer is good. So.
And Jason was telling me that he's excited about comics again. And now he did say that.
He's very impressed about comics.
I'd like to think he's in a groove. And we're going to see just 2 more issues.
When will the next issue?
Done by the end of the summer.
Okay. Yay. All right. Well, that's good. I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to let people know, about this momentous moment?
The three of us, Julia Bohr in our store, came across this book from the French publisher Hugo Comex called So We Have a Couple in English, and she gave it to us.
No, so it's uncomfortably.
So she gave the book to Chris, and Chris really, Chris liked it, so he gave the book to me, and I read it, but I'm not that good at reading in French yet, so I read it far enough that I could tell that I liked it. And so I had a Korean cartoonist, so I got in touch with him, and then we were talking about who to translate it, because we didn't know anyone who was reading Korean. So then someone said, you should speak to Helen Judge. She speaks Korean. So it's unofficially, we're publishing this book. Helen told us in English, the real title is called Uncomfortably Happily. And she's going to translate the book, and we're going to announce that pretty soon in the next 2 weeks. So that was a really fun one that we all were excited about and got behind. And we're excited that...
Is there any questions out there? Anybody have questions? Yes.
Hi. All the cartoonists work really hard, and they're dedicated to their art. And for the longest time, it doesn't pay for them. How long it was a hobby before it became you were able to pay your rent as an editor? Because this is a dedication to the comic art form.
Like last year.
The thing is with it became successful pretty quickly. That's the funny thing. As I mentioned at the very beginning, so much of this happened so fast, like in the first 12 to 18 months. You know, we started publishing, you know, Julie and Seth and Chester and so on. It didn't really necessarily pay my salary for probably a few years, but it did cover everything. You know, we had no government grants at all. So basically, for the first 10 years or so, the company paid for itself, you know, based on sales.
Breaking even.
Yeah, you could say it was breaking even. Yeah.
We owe a lot to living in Montreal. It's a very affordable city.
Yeah, Montreal's very cheap, and that's the only way it couldn't. That probably could not have happened in another city. Chris couldn't have afforded to do it, or Marina couldn't have afforded to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like, you know, just living with Tom in New York City, and, you know, even if we hadn't moved to Montreal, there was going to be a time limit on high water books because I was going to have to get a job.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brandon Hayward, please report to the security desk. Would Brent Hayward please report to the security desk? Thank you.
Oh boy.
So we always, it's just not Woody, so that's good. But really, Montreal is a dream city to have a business of everyone. You can have new employees come in. And, you know, even though the rents are higher, they're still so much cheaper than other cities.
It probably took 20 years for Chris to actually make a real salary. It took a long time.
That's
yeah, he
I
wasn't
think
really
very important
drawing on the company
thing.
For a very long time. That was, you know,
I guess not
the insistence of us that is like, you gotta, you know, actually be paid. Because we want to be paid. That was unfair.
We actually, he made us take it out of the book that he didn't get paid. So I don't want to be the person who just sits there and says, I never got paid.
I mean, how a plastic Chris Oliveros is this? We just take it out of the essay that Chris didn't get paid. We slipped it in somewhere else. But he just, he's like, I don't want to be that person. He's just saying that that wasn't what it was about for him.
Any other questions out there? Anybody else have a question? I guess I'll leave the panel with one, with the, you know, what are your goals? You know, I mean, you've come so far. I mean, is there another challenge yet to meet that you want to? What's the big dream?
Oh, business-wise, for me, just in the business end, I just want to be stable. We want to have a succession plan in place. We want to be able to survive now. We want to be able to survive for the years. And being stable, like, we just have started to feel stable in the last few years. And it's kind of like this wonderful feeling, like, it's just, wow, this feels great. You know, this is.
I want to publish everything.
And I want it to be stable.
Okay.
Chris, help us.
Chris, I mean, you know, just learning how to be a cartoonist again, or, you know, you've been doing it, but, you know, what's your dream? What's your next dream?
You know, again, just that's my own personal goals. But it's also great to see John Corley in this position, because, I mean, like I said, 10 years ago I couldn't have done this. And I think around the time when Kim Thompson died a couple of years ago, it also made me realize that it's very, how important it is to actually plan for something like this, because a lot of independent companies don't survive. You know, second, or even definitely, you know, rarely into the third generation. So it's really important to make sure that all the talent is there, and that certainly has been happening with B&Q. I mean, the funny thing is that with comics publishing, there really was no industry period whatsoever. There was no infrastructure. There were very few stores. There was no, you know, conventions like this. It wasn't being taught in schools. And what you've seen in the last 10, 20 years is that this infrastructure is actually being built up. And so that's really important to actually have that next generation.
The Archie story is sad too.
Sure.
You know, like, the Archie story is sad that, you know, the second generation has the company and it's just infighting and lawsuits. And, you know, it seems like a crazy company to compare yourself to, but they're independently owned. And it's not much different. And so, we were just like, you know, Chris and I were just like, well, we have to, this is even before I knew he wanted to leave and become a cartoonist. We had conversations that we had to figure it out and, you know, put something in place because we wanted to have a plan for the company.
Because it is, you know, it is more of an industry now than when you all started with these crazy dreams, you know? You never, Chris, did you think this, you didn't think this would happen? Or
no, I mean, I was mentioning this last night at our gathering. I could never have imagined, like, 25 years ago that it could be, you know, what it is now. I can't believe that I've been working with, like, the very best cartoonists in the media anywhere in the world. I think of it now, like, how is this even possible? So, yeah, it's fantastic that it's has largely worked out.
And I think, like, who we've published in the last 18 months, and my mind is just blown, like, the names you're able to say, just in an 18-month period, we're not talking about 25 years. So in 18 months, we have published Jason, Adrian, Linda Berry, Anders Nielsen, Tolik Johnson, Chester Brown, Gilbert Hernandez, like, just in a tiny window of DMQ history, we've published the very best cartoons and the best variety, and it's just mind-blowing. And it's funny because we start each season with almost nothing on the list. We're like, what do we add? What are we going to do for fall 2016? We've got nothing. And then all of a sudden, within a week, all these amazing books from amazing cartoonists come in. It's awesome.
And I feel very confident that we will continue to see many amazing books, including The Envelope Maker. So, you know, thank you guys. Thank you so much, Ron Corey. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.